tonight I'd like to talk about the unshakable mind. I found a list in the Visuddhimagga, chapter 12. That's the list I'll be referring to tonight, which was talking about the qualities, the conditions, the roots that give rise to what they, in the book, they call an unperturbable mind. Now, the reason I'm calling it an unshakable mind is I can't keep saying the word unperturbable. So I'm going to call it unshakable instead. Let myself off the hook. Essentially, it's what we all want meditation to be. We all want to be unperturbable. We want to be able to rest our mind, watching the rise and fall of the breathing process, and for that not to be disturbed. We want to be able to quieten the mind, develop our samadhi, develop our tranquility, and to develop insight, for which we need a mind that isn't running off here, there, and everywhere, and is such a trial to try and tame. So this is a really interesting list. Now, what I'm not going to go through the 16 items on the list. What a boring talk that would be. But I hope to incorporate some of the ideas in the list. So if you wanted to look at the list of these 16 qualities yourself, you can check out chapter 12 in the Visuddhimagga. And if you don't know what the Visuddhimagga is, then I'll be in the library afterwards and I can show you. There are five of those qualities on the list which I think are preeminent. So if you think of like the roots of a tree reaching down, they give stability to the tree itself, don't they? So even though there can be like a gale or a storm, the tree remains unperturbed because it's got these deep roots which nourish it and support it and stop it from falling down. And so these first five qualities are what in Buddhism are known as the five spiritual faculties. So the five mental factors, which is really useful for everyone to have a really good working understanding of. And the five are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So a brief description of the five for you. What is faith? Faith is that quality of placing confidence in something and also of resolving upon something. So I remember 1994, being in a pub with two friends, moaning about life and how miserable I was and how wrong everything was. And one of them said, "Well, why don't you come to India with us?" And there was in that moment this quality of resolution, of resolving upon something, of gaining confidence in something, of faith emerging. Because I knew in that instance that was exactly what I was going to do. And it was this tremendous sense of settledness that came with that. Lovely sense of settledness. What was now absent was the wavering, the oscillating between possibilities. I'd given myself a direction. It wasn't the end of the story. I was going to have to do lots. I was going to have to, work out how to get to India, what I needed, what inoculations I needed. I needed a visa. I needed to, there's all so many things that you need to do in order to sort it out. But there was that sense of direction and a sense of confidence in the direction that had been chosen. And so that's that quality of faith. It is a resolving quality, a quality that gives confidence to any kind of undertaking. And what we're talking about with these five spiritual faculties are found in all walks of life, but being spiritual faculties, they are designated as belonging to the spiritual path that leads to the resolution of the problem of suffering. Faith gives rise to a resolution and a choice and a sense of direction, which takes away the wavering of being offered so many different choices and so forth. And so that gives rise to energy, because you can't just think something would be a good idea. You have to go and find out, don't you? I could have been sat in the pub and just thought, yeah, that's a really fantastic idea. But that wouldn't be enough. You have to employ energy, don't you? So you've got your 1% inspiration, and then you've got your 99% perspiration. So what is energy? Energy is putting forth effort. It is pushing through inertia. It's that process of making movement, of causing something to happen. So just keep these ideas in mind when it comes to meditation itself. So there is that sense of pushing through inertia, pushing through resistance, of causing something to happen. That's what we mean by energy. So you've got a direction and you're putting forth energy to make this thing, this aspiration, whatever it might be, happen. What else do you need? Well, you need mindfulness. There has to be awareness of, or say in the case of going to India, there had to be awareness of what I would need, awareness of all the problems related to how do you get to India and what do you do when you get to India, and all of that. So there had to be awareness of what was actually taking place. So what do we mean by mindfulness? In terms of the spiritual factors, what we mean by mindfulness is the non-judgmental, choiceless awareness of what is right at this moment. The non-judgmental, important, non-judgmental, choiceless, important, awareness of what is actually taking place in your experience at this moment. So there's awareness, there's a route, there's a path, there is the desire to go on the path, there is the energy undertaken to undertake the path, there is the mindfulness, the awareness, but it also requires focus. There are so many things that take place in life, we can't be aware of them all. So we all routinely choose what it is that we're going to focus on. So yes, you have the choiceless awareness of what's unfolding, but then within that, you can then focus on what you consider to be the essential elements, and the necessary elements. So if I'm going to India, I could just spend all my time reading Lonely Planet Guide to India or whatever it might be, but at that time the most important thing? Wouldn't it be more important to focus on getting my visa, getting my inoculations, and maybe I can do the looking at the guidebook a little bit later on? Yeah, so we can make choices within what we're doing. So we need focus. Focus takes away the unnecessary parts and allows us to hone in on what is essential. And so there has to be also investigation. What do I do to go to get my visa? Where do I go to get my inoculations? Where do I go to get? I'm going back way too far. About to talk about traveller's checks. Do they even happen now? Traveller's checks? Are they still a thing? No, they went with the. Oh God, I'm old. I'm going back, I'm revisiting 1994, that's what it is. So anyway, yeah, make sure you've got your cards with you. So there has to be investigation. You have to come to an understanding of things. If you're going to India, it's a very good idea to understand some of the local customs and expectations in terms of your behaviour, perhaps learn some of the language. So there's investigation in order to come to an understanding of things. So that's the quality of wisdom. After all, that's why we're practicing meditation, isn't it? We want to become wise so that we can do away with suffering. So there's a brief description of these five factors. Now, terms of meditation, these five factors are hugely important supports and roots for developing this unshakable mind. So the question is then becomes, well, how do you come by these five spiritual faculties? Well, firstly, you already have them. all these qualities are naturally occurring qualities in the human mind, so you don't have to create them, but you can develop them. And they're developed in all kinds of ways. Developing an ethical way of life, so within the parameters of the Buddhist teaching, developing ethics, so keeping precepts, will develop five spiritual faculties. Developing what we call the parami, so those are compassionate actions such as generosity, kindness, service, will develop the five spiritual faculties. Any relatively unselfish act will develop the five spiritual faculties. So, making someone a cup of tea, whatever it is, just listening to someone who's got troubles and just being there to listen will develop five spiritual faculties, because you're putting aside your selfish preoccupation for the benefit of something greater. Discipline. So, as you know, we have parameters for coming along to the centre. It is a training. And we want to train these five spiritual faculties. We want to develop them. So we say, oh, come along for six Wednesdays in a row. But we do mean come along for six Wednesdays in a row as an introduction. In the course of coming along for six Wednesdays, practicing meditation every day, you develop the five spiritual faculties. And then, having completed that and successfully completed that, you say, yeah, I still want to carry on. We say, all right, so minimum of a weekend retreat within the first 6 months and a week's retreat within the first year. That sounds so frightening. And yet you keep going, you practice meditation every day, keep coming along on Wednesdays, and eventually you pluck up the courage and go on the retreat. You've booked it. And the important thing in developing the five spiritual faculties, when you promise to do something and you pull through with that, then you develop the spiritual faculties. And you develop the spiritual faculties by coming on the retreat, by finding out all about it, getting through it, and then being able to assess and review it afterwards and determine whether you want to carry on. Even the discipline of coming along this evening is developing the five spiritual faculties. Being a day student and committing to come along every week during the course of a season, on your particular day, that act and the resolve of honouring that and pulling through on that is developing the five spiritual faculties. That's why the discipline is there. It's to help you develop those five spiritual faculties, because they will come to act as strong roots for your meditation practice and help to keep your meditation practice really stable and unshakable. So that's why the discipline is there. Well, they say of mindfulness, well, how do you develop mindfulness? How do you start developing mindfulness? Well, it's just with the act of trying. So any time you sit down to practice, to seriously practice meditation, you are developing the five spiritual faculties. So it's all there within the training. Okay, so let's talk more about what this stable, unshakable mind actually is. When you first sit down to meditate, I wonder if it's your experience that when you first sit down, literally within the first few moments, and you command the mind to observe the rise and fall of the breathing process as it occurs at the abdomen, you pretty much do that. The mind does that. At least for the first few seconds. Oh, I'm seeing for you. No, Paul, I've never heard of that before. What's that? The occasional nod would help. So, all right. So, well, it is the case that often when we first sit down to meditate, we take a few deep breaths, we locate the rise and fall of the breathing process, and the mind is just there, just watching. Now, that is a perfectly balanced meditation right there. That is all it needs to be. There is no exalted other thing that you're supposed to accomplish. It is just that moment when you sit down and you're just that first few moments when you're just observing the breathing process, that is perfect meditation. That's perfect balance. Okay? Then what happens? Then something else happens. And within a short space of time, we're either in a dream world, or we've got a head which feels like it's being clamped to something, or we're frazzled, anxious, annoyed, dejected, or we can't be bothered suddenly. And this is, of course, the opposite of an unshakable mind. This is the mind shaking. Right? And what I'd like to do is just, if it's at all possible, just to imagine that mind which is just in that beautiful place where it is just observing the breathing process, because it's such a natural, normal, simple state of mind. It's such a normal state of mind. It's not extra special, but it is the right space for meditation. And then we've got to start looking at, well, okay, well, what's coming in and interfering then? What's causing all this storm and, you know, disturbance? What's coming in and causing that? Okay, all right. So we're just watching the breath. That itself is an act of faith. It's you know, you don't know what's going to happen. You're just content to watch the breath. There's energy there going into actually observing the breathing process. There's mindfulness. This non-judgmental, choiceless awareness of what is taking place in the moment, and there's the seeing of that, so there's the understanding of what's actually going on in that moment. Okay. Those are the five spiritual faculties, and everything's good. Now, one of the things that comes along and unsettles the mind is an attraction to something. And in the book it states that one of the aspects of a stable mind, this unshakable mind, is that it remains unattracted. A mind that remains unattracted just continues to observe the breathing process, but it remains unattracted, which means that it understands that there's something else there, but it's just not interested in it. What normally happens is something else comes along and we become very interested in it. Yeah? And because of that interest, we lose the stability of the mind. The mind then starts shaking, as it were, because it's become interested in something. Now, one way of dealing with that, the wrong way of dealing with that, is to go, well, I shouldn't acknowledge anything else that's going on then. I should keep everything else at bay so that I can just remain watching the breathing process. But the problem with that is you've created a very brittle state of mind that is petrified that anything could come along and spoil the meditation. So it's already lost its imperturbability. It's already shaken. And it's shaken because you haven't included the thing that you find so attractive. You've tried to keep it out. And so already you've got a conflict in the meditation. Yeah. So what you have to do is the really brave thing, which is why you need the faith. You have to accept the possibility of the mind becoming interested in something else. And you have to be willing to allow for that to happen. Because only through allowing it to happen can you understand in experience what we're talking about at this time, that the mind does indeed become attracted to other things. Might be a memory, might be a sound outside, but the mind becomes interested, it finds it attractive. So that's where we lose the stability. But that's fine. That's why you need the faith. Because what we need to do is develop the wisdom, the understanding that that's what's going on. So the meditation has to be inclusive. It's not an exclusive thing. If you try to make meditation exclusive of everything else, you create a very brittle state of mind. So it has to be inclusive. So you have to have the faith to allow for the fact that the mind will be attracted to other things. And gradually you learn through experience that to retain that unshakable nature of the mind, you have to understand that it's all right for attractive things to arise in the meditation and that you remain unattracted. So you acknowledge the attraction and then bring the mind back. I know I'm going to make this sound really easy, aren't I? It's the same with things that we're repelled by. So we try to create this environment, meditative environment, where nothing that we find repellent is going to occur. And then what happens, we're meditating and somebody else who's meditating is breathing too loudly for us, and suddenly something repellent is happening and we cannot get rid of it. So it's exactly the same thing. The meditation has to be inclusive of the things that we find repellent. Sorry about that. Nothing I can do. So that, again, that's why we need the faith. We need the faith and the energy. Oh, I could go through all the spiritual faculties. I won't keep doing that. So you have to include those objects, those things that the mind finds repellent. And you learn over time, you gain the wisdom through going through this process of, again, come back to the mindfulness as being non-judgmental, choiceless awareness of what's actually taking place. You become aware of that the mind has become keenly disgusted by something and doesn't want it to happen. So there's the arising of the irritation, there's the arising of the frustration. And so all of that has to be included too. So you learn over time to include those uncomfortable mental qualities. And there's the noting of them, and then there's the returning of the mind. And there is a burdening knowledge that the unshakable state of mind remains unrepelled. Right? So on the one hand, it remains unattracted, and it also remains unrepelled. That's the nature of an unshakable mind. There are a couple of other uns as well. There's the undejected mind and the unelated mind. So these are two qualities of this unshakability. Why do we get dejected and why do we get elated? They're two sides of the same coin. It's because we have a predetermined idea of what we think should be happening in the meditation. So if you've got this idea that meditation should all be about tranquility and bliss and happiness and joy, and then you're in a meditation and you're getting, you know, perturbed by somebody doing something else, you know, and that is the opposite of what you wanted the meditation to be, because of your attachment to that idea of what you thought meditation should be, you completely ignore the reality and the fact that you can include all these qualities in the reality, and you become dejected because the meditation isn't what you wanted it to be. And that leads then to indolence, because you go, oh, no point trying. So the truly stable mind is, but you see how flexible the truly stable mind. It's not a brittle sort of control thing. It's lovely and open. It's flexible. It's dynamic. It allows for, oh, the mind's going over there. Okay, oh, the mind's going over there. All right, let's bring it back here. And you master it over time. The dejection and the self-pity arise because you were holding, you were grasping onto a wrong idea of meditation. And the corollary to that is elation, which is that moment when everything happens exactly as you thought it should. And you get all those qualities that you think should be there. And the meditation is lost in an instant. It just becomes totally agitated and like, oh, I think I'm going to become enlightened any moment, sort of thing. You know, and it's just so... Well, that's what it's like for me. So you have to be... But again, it's ignorant. It's not understanding that, well, all this lovely bliss and tranquility and peace came through developing the meditation in a certain way, and suddenly now those things have arrived, and suddenly you're doing something completely different. So immediately all those states are lost, and then you're going back into the dejection. And all because you had an idea of what you think things should be, as opposed to just acknowledging, mindfully acknowledging what's actually taking place. So in an unshakable mind, the mind remains undejected and unelated. Okay. Also, there is, in an unshakable mind, the mind remains untrammeled. Oh, I love this one. I love this one. An untrammeled mind. Well, what is a trammeled mind? That's the mind that feels like your head's been put in a vice. Where everything trammeled means like it's like everything's been placed in a little box. There isn't enough room. That's what trammeled means. And this comes from, again, having an idea of what you think the meditation should be and trying to manipulate and force the mind to conform to that shape. And in the book it states it as greed accompanied by zeal. Okay, now zeal, that's the chanda I was talking about earlier. That's the desire to do, but it's associated with the unwholesome quality of greed, which is, I'm going to force this meditation to be what I want it to be. And that's very painful for the person that does it. And one of the problems is that we don't understand the degree of energy that's actually required for meditation. It tends to be the person who is more yang than yin, if you see what I mean, more proactive. You know, I've got results in my life through putting effort in and, you know, making things happen. And so we don't even know that we're doing it because it's so second nature. But it is an imbalance of energy. Yes, we need energy to get things moving. You have to have energy to push through initial inertia. It's a really good idea. For instance, if you have trouble with settling down to meditate in the evening, you know, after a day at work and having had a meal and watched some telly and anything, like it's 9 o'clock, it's now or never for doing the meditation. And then it's, well, okay, never then. that's not very helpful for your meditative development. And we want to develop those five spiritual faculties, so it's a really good idea to get down to. Okay, backtrack through your day. And like early in the morning when you get up, think to yourself, develop the zeal for the practice. Develop that chanda, that desire to do. Think, all right, this evening, after I've had some food and I've watched some telly and whatever else you need to do, at 9 o'clock, I will go to sit and meditate. And then look forward to it. Create a sense of relish. And then throughout the day, just remind yourself, oh, that's what I'm going to do at 9 o'clock. Or whenever, you know. And it's just reminding yourself and go, oh, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And you build up this momentum, which carries you through that initial inertia. Because it's just a change of state. Because you're so happy when you do it. You know, it's like if you don't do it, it's like, oh, I didn't do it. But if you do it, you go, I did it. it's like you get that little kick, that little successful volition. So it's really helpful just to backtrack that desire to do that chanda earlier in the day and create that zeal. And it'll just help you push through. So energy, though, is a very subtle business. You have to balance the energy dependent on what's actually taking place. And I go back to my observation that actually your first few observations of the breathing process when you first sit down to meditate is the right balance. And you say, yeah, but I haven't even settled down. Yeah, exactly. You're just watching the breath. And what tends to happen with people with a proactive attitude is that they think that they have to do something to make the mind look at the breath. And that's too much. It doesn't. Like, look at the shrine. How much effort did it take? Are you like this and go, look at the shrine! Look at the shrine! Look at it! Look at it! You don't, do you? You just don't. You just go, that's a shrine. It's the same with the breath. If there is the command, look at the breath, the mind will look at the breath. But then we go, okay, look at the breath, look at the breath, look at the breath, got to look at the breath. And that's the extra that you don't need. Okay? So it's a subtle business. So what do we need to do in meditation then? coming back to what is the unshakable nature of the mind? Well, the unshakable nature of the mind that it's untrammeled, because you've learned through experience what's too much, and you've learned to restrain the excess to the point where you sit down and you just go, right, oh look, there it is. No extra volition, no extra, come on, really, really try. There's just the mind looking at the breath. And what's in absence there is a self-concern. It's just, you know, just it is being looked at. So I don't need to do any more than that. Okay, so everyone can do it. It just takes time, effort, and intelligent application, which you develop if you persist with it. But it is possible to reach a point where, for protracted periods of time, the mind is just resting, observing the breathing process. It's not at war with anything else that's going on. It recognizes when it's becoming attracted to something. It recognizes when it's being repelled by something. It recognizes when it's becoming dejected. It recognizes when it's become elated. It's learned all about what the mind gets up to. It recognizes when there's too many volitions going in, and it pulls back. And you learn. It's not that the mind becomes set. It's not a static state of mind. It's like riding a bike. It's like the degree of imbalance is just minute, and you're just adjusting minutely all the time, and just holding it there. And then it becomes possible to investigate your experience more deeply. Yes, we can learn to focus on the breathing to the exclusion of everything else from there, when you can really unify the mind and have a really blissful experience, but that's all it'll be. It'll only ever be a blissful experience. You can use this unshakable mind to then investigate the true nature of the components that go to make up each and every conscious experience, and this is what we call Vipassana meditation. Having developed this unshakability, it's possible to look at absolutely anything. And, well, another way you develop the five spiritual faculties is by undertaking the insight training and going through all the insight knowledges. And as you progress through the insight knowledges, you come up against so many things. You realize that the world wasn't exactly as you thought it was. You realize that you weren't exactly as you thought you were. So many assumptions, so many delusions are eradicated through simply attending to observing the true nature of one's experience. Everything, every component part of experience that arises is transient and conditioned. And the more you look, the more you understand that you cannot, it is not possible to grasp onto any component of experience. It's all just arising and passing away. And you reach, at the end of the day, you reach this lovely point where you've looked at absolutely everything in your experience, and you find it all to be arising and passing away, all entirely unsatisfactory. To grasp onto them would only be painful. And you literally, you just let everything go free. There is no grasping after any component. And you reach a point where, and this isn't in the books, but this struck me when I was thinking about this talk, that you have this perfectly unshakable mind that is absolutely in the world, but is absolutely free of it at the same time. That the mind remains, the truly stable mind remains unidentified with phenomena. And by that I mean, the mind no longer grasps after any aspect of mind and body as being me, mine, or myself. There is just what is arising in experience. And that is a truly stable mind, because at that point there is no division anywhere at all. There is no sense of loss, no sense of dissatisfaction, no sense of being unfulfilled. There is just the joy of the mystery of existence. But it is a truly stable mind, in the sense that, as a last thought, even if a meteorite the size of the Isle of Wight were to hit Earth at 1,000,000 miles an hour, it would not even scratch that mind, that truly stable mind, that liberated mind, that mind that no longer identifies.